Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Tammy Carver. Welcome to the John Carver Show. My husband has helped thousands of people around the world lead happier and more successful lives. Whether you're just beginning to lay your foundation or you've already built your life but need to shore up some weak spots, this show will help you.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
So today I want to share some thoughts with you on the theme of filling in the wrong blanks. Filling in the wrong blanks. Have you ever talked to somebody? I know it's happened to me numerous times that I'm talking to somebody and I proceed to share a story or a comment and they fill in what they think I'm going to say when it's not the same case at all. And the other way around, sometimes folks are talking to me and I fill in the rest of their story when it's not at all where they were going with the story. And most of the time when you and I hear something, our mind fills in the blanks with the details that may or may not be very accurate. So today I want to share, among other things, four stories from the scriptures that kind of illustrate that point of filling in the wrong blanks. A guy named Lemony Snicket writes, who's not in the Bible, by the way, for those who don't know, says, making assumptions simply mean believing things are a certain way with little or no evidence at all that shows you are correct. How many times have we looked at people and stereotyped them because they look a certain way, or they dress a certain way, or they even sound a certain way? I can remember years ago when I was a kid, I would say, or maybe in my teens, that I thought that people with a southern drawl were less intelligent from those people from the north. I have no idea where that came from or why I thought that. But again, we stereotype people all the time. What if what's possible makes no sense at all? What if the stereotypes, or what if the views that you have about other people really make no sense at all? Now, the problem is that most people start out with a clean sheet of paper. They grow up and they have all these things that show up in their lives that make them stereotype and view people certain ways. Over in the book of John, if you want to turn over there, in the book of John chapter 6, I just want to share a small piece of this story. But in John chapter 6, starting in verse 5, let me just share the story. Let me share the backstory of it. Jesus had been teaching for several hours in a particular day, and a crowd of people followed him, and they were following him all day and into the evening. And they found a situation where these people were far from home, they were very hungry, and the story starts, or actually in the middle of the story in verse 5, it says, when he looked up and saw a large crowd coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, who was one of his men, his followers, where are we to buy bread for these people to eat? He said this to test him, for he, Jesus, knew what he was going to do. So Philip answered, 6 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little bit. Now the story goes on to kind of share that Jesus took a little bit and made a lot out of it. How many times when you look at stuff going on in your life that you can only see the small amount, when people with, I think, more experience maybe and more miles on their journey can see the possibilities in the little bit. Again, that's in my view at least a form of stereotyping or looking at things that you really don't know the whole story. A guy named Philip Houston writes, advances are made by answering questions and discoveries are made by questioning answers. I think Jesus was trying to get Philip to maybe see what was impossible, to maybe see what was not likely to happen, but what could happen when Jesus was on the scene. A guy named Miguel Ruiz writes, If others tell you something, we make things, we assume things. And if they don't tell us something, we make assumptions to fulfill our need to know and to replace the need to communicate. Stop and think about it. Let me just share that piece again. If others tell us something, we make assumptions. And if they don't tell us something, we make assumptions to fulfill our need to know and replace the need to communicate. He goes on to say, even if we hear something and we don't understand, we make assumptions about what it means and then believe the assumptions. We all make all sorts of assumptions because we don't have the courage to ask questions. How many times haven't you been in relationships, whether they're at work, whether they're at school, that you just look at somebody and without asking a question or two or three or four about that person, you just assume and you go for years, maybe a lifetime, thinking that something is true when it's really not. Rochelle Goodrich writes, while you judge me by my outward appearances, I am silently doing the same to you, even though there's a 90% chance that in both cases, all assumptions are wrong. How many times haven't you looked at people in your own life who've judged you and assumed things about you when they don't really know the story at all? Lori Myers shares, don't build roadblocks out of assumptions. How many times haven't you come across friends that became friends that at one time you didn't even like them or assumed certain things about them that weren't even true? There's another story in Joshua chapter 2 in the Old Testament of the Bible, which I think is stereotypical, forgive the pun, of how we judge people and how maybe we don't think that people with certain characteristics or certain backgrounds can help us at all. So if you want to turn there over to Joshua 2, let me kind of set the backstory for you. Moses was the guy who led the captives who were in Egypt, out of Egypt. There's a longer story behind that. We're not going to go there today. So there came a point when Moses passed away, and they came to a place where they were promised this certain land, this certain piece of ground, a certain country eventually, but it wasn't going to be handed to them on a platter. They had to work for it. They had to fight for it. They had to earn it. So Joshua was put in charge. And in Joshua chapter 2, in the first verse, it says, then Joshua, the son of Nun, spelled N-U-N, sent out two men as spies secretly to this place called the Acacia Grove, the translation is, saying, go view this land, especially Jericho. So they went and came into the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab and lodged there. Now, certainly, if I was those two gentlemen, I would have looked for at least a Motel 6. I would look for a Holiday Inn, if they still have Holiday Inns, or some other form of place where I could lay my head. J. Vernon McGee called her a shady character. A shady character. They came into the house of a harlot to stay there, to spend the night, to sleep. Yeah, okay. So why did they go to the harlot's house? Why would they choose the harlot? Why would they choose the prostitute's house? I don't necessarily have all those answers right here today, but the Hebrew says, the Hebrew tongue, or how it was written at the time, said that they went to the harlot's house to lay down. Now, again, you could read into those comments any which way you choose, but this context says that they were just there to sleep. Okay. So in verse 2, it says, it was told the king, and the king in this city, in this area, was Amalek. And Amalek was the first foe, F-O-E, that attacked the Israelites one of the first foes, when they came out of Egypt and entered this new land. So Amalek and his minions, so to speak, knew of the Israelites, knew of Joshua, knew of what they were able to do through God doing wonderful things. So again, it was told the king in verse 2 of Jericho saying, behold, men from the sons of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land. And the king of Jericho sent word to Rahab saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out the land. Now, the spies were obviously spotted by somebody. because the king heard about it. The king knew that they were there, and it was very curious to me, if you kind of read between these lines, this is the king, the dude that runs the entire town. So he sends somebody to this harlot's house and asks permission for her to surrender these guys. There's a backstory to that too. I'll get to that in a bit, possibly. Verse 4. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them, and she said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from." I'm in Joshua 2, verse 5. "It came about when it was time to shut the gate in the dark that the men went out. I do not know where the men went. So pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them." But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them in the stalks of flax, which she had laid in order on the roof. Again, more backstory. In that part of the world, the roofs were flat, and they would take the stalks of whatever they grew, put them on the roof to dry out. Okay. So in verse 7, "So the men pursued them on the road to the Jordan, to the fords. And as soon as those who were pursuing them had gone out, they shut the gate. Then the woman took the two men and hid them." So again, you see a situation where the harlot was obviously in the story lying. How and why they ended up there, I don't have all that answer, but I think there's a piece of this story that we'll get to momentarily. Now, I think in that culture, and if you read more historically of that culture, that women had a lot of rights, whereas in other parts of the region, that was not the case at all. In fact, a few scholars I read called her an innkeeper and not a harlot. Some others called her a madam, which would mean a person over many harlots. I don't know what the whole story is, but I know that they were in a place that did business of not very good kind. So in verse 8, it says this: "Now, before they lay down, she came to them on the roof and said to them," I'm in Joshua 2, verse 9, listen, this is the harlot. This is the woman who lives on the outside of town, okay, on the edge, okay, of this town. "I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you have utterly destroyed. When we heard it," listen, verse 11, "when we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, he is the God in heaven above and on earth beneath." So Rahab knew the reputation of God, and she knew that she should treat these men with respect. Now my question, just from my observation, is how did the guys know that Rahab knew and was afraid and had respect for God? I didn't find how she knew that, other than the story was in the newspaper and she heard about it. So when these guys came to the house, maybe it was a happenstance, maybe God was directing them to that house. Maybe they were invited through another source. I don't really know. All I know is that they were at the right place at the right time for somebody that would be unexpectedly pro them, to help them in a way that blew their mind. So how could the spies have known that Rahab was going to help them? Now, if you don't turn there, but in the New Testament, Hebrews, it says, "By faith, Rahab," this is Hebrews saying, "by faith, Rahab the prostitute did not perish with those who were disobedient, because she had received the spies in peace." Another way to kind of say that, maybe in another place, is her works justified her. Her works enabled her to be blessed by God, because even though she had baggage, even though she had a stereotype, even though she had a history that wasn't quote-unquote godly, God respected her faithfulness to the people of God. A guy named T.K. Coleman writes, "Positive assumptions are needed only when you have negative assumptions that you're trying to overcome." They say, but when you drop your assumptions altogether, your soul stands naked in the open fields of possibility. And what you choose to create from that space is up to you. Again, so oftentimes we If we choose to replace the assumptions that aren't accurate with maybe an open mind, we see possibilities that we hadn't seen before because we set aside what we think it should be versus what it really is. Back to Joshua 2 in verse 12. Now, therefore, this is Rahab talking to the two men, to the two spies in verse 12. Now, therefore, please swear to me by the Lord, since I have dealt with you kindly with my father's household, and give me a pledge of truth, and spare my father and my mother and my brothers and my sisters and all who belong to them, and deliver the lives, our lives from death. So the men said to her, oh, our life for yours, if you do not tell this business of ours, and it shall come about when the Lord gives us this land that we will deal kindly and faithfully with you. So I think it's fairly obvious that in Rahab's mind, she wanted a win-win here. She said, look, I'm going to scratch your back, but I need you to scratch my back. And not just my back too, but my family's back. I need you to cover my back, okay? Because I've stuck my neck way out for you. Now, I need you to make sure that when you eventually take over Jericho, because I know it's going to happen. It's not a matter of if. It's a matter of when, because you've done so much else. God has enabled you to do so much before. I know we're on the radar. I know we're going to be somewhere down the line going to be attacked. Okay, I know that. So because I have dealt well with you, I want to make sure that there's a win-win here. So in verse 15, it says, then she let them down by a rope for her house. Listen, for her house was on the city wall, so that she was living on the wall. Now let's pause momentarily. Could it be that the spies had spotted out this city for so long, a number of days or weeks, or I don't know, and maybe they knew that her establishment was on the wall, that maybe she could have been somebody that could have been swayed just a little bit because people knew her through her business, in quotes, and people knew about her. So maybe she was the one in that city who had potential to help them. I don't know. I'm just guessing here. Verse 16. She said to them, go into the hill country so that the pursuers will not happen upon you, and hang out there for 3 days until they return. Then afterwards you may go your way. So the men said to her, we shall be free from this oath to you which you have made us swear, unless we have come into the land. You tie this cord of scarlet thread on the thing here and let us down and gather to yourself into the house and your father and your mother. He goes on to say. So in other words, the story ends with that when we come back to overtake this town, have this scarlet thread so that our people can identify you are for us, that we won't attack. So and skip over to Joshua 6, the end of the story. Joshua 6, verse 23. Again, Joshua 6, verse 23. It says, so the young men who were spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and her mother and her brothers and all the other relatives. They also brought and placed them outside the camp of Israel. Now, the story doesn't stop there. They placed them. There's a cultural task here that was done, because these were foreigners. They couldn't maybe be trusted, so they set them outside the camp. But just two verses down the road, verse 25, however, Rahab the harlot and her father's household and all she had, Joshua spared. And she, listen, and she lived in the midst of Israel to this day, for she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. So not only did she start out in the enemy's camp, she was part of that culture. She saved the people that were going to overtake that city, for sure. Then they were led out of that town and not quite brought into the family of the Israelites. But very shortly after that, she was then embraced by everybody, even though she had a stereotype, even though she had an image that wasn't especially very holy to Hebrews, that worshipped Elohim and God and had all the sacrificial stuff that they had to do. They welcomed her in. Somebody named Susie Kasem writes, a lion of truth never assumes anything without validity. They never assume anything without ability. Assumptions, listen, I like this one because this is so true for all of us. Assumptions are quick exits for lazy minds. Assumptions are quick exits for lazy minds that like to graze out in the fields without bother. You've worked with them, and I've worked with them. We tend to judge people without having all the facts. Chris Jammy writes, when I look at a person, I see a person, not a rank, not a class, not even a title. For me, and I can't speak for you, maybe it's lack of respect, I don't know, but I don't like titles. Because to me, titles put an image on somebody when really they're just a human being. They just have a job, they have a role, they have a hat that they particularly wear in a certain situation. So assumptions are, I think most of the time, not based in facts. Sometimes they are, granted, but I think more times than not, they're not based in facts at all. Jonathan Swift wrote years ago, it is useless to attempt to reason a man out of a thing he has never reasoned into. Let me share that again. It is useless to attempt to reason a man out of anything he was reasoned into, or not reasoned into, excuse me. So again, judging people or assuming stuff without getting the facts is the easy way to do it. It takes time, effort, energy, discipline, hard work to learn what you need to learn in order to get the information what you need to. In fact, I read an article in Talkback Trash and Treasure. I have no clue who the publisher is. But they said, when most of us think of the Vikings, we think of fearsome warriors wearing horned helmets. I think every image we can remember have these guys wearing these horned helmets. Or perhaps their caricature of Hagar the Horrible, these comic strips, right? But did you know that Vikings never wore horns on their helmets? They would have snagged on other things, but the Scandinavian Viking raiders and traders who swept through Europe so effectively were pagans. So leaders in the Christian church at the time had to demonize them, and hence they depicted them at every opportunity with horns. So all these years, we have this image that isn't so true. Now, we're talking hundreds of years ago. What about in the last 50 years? What about in the last 100 years? We, as a culture, as Americans, stereotype people that, again, I'll say it 10 times here today, that most stereotypes are wrong. Most stereotypes are because we lack the discipline and the work and the effort to really look at things deeper. Rebecca Nathan writes, culture can be invisible to its natives. Think about this a minute. Culture can be invisible to the native, which means that when you're in the middle of stuff, you don't see the stuff that you're in. In fact, I can't remember who said it or probably got the quote wrong, but fish don't realize that they're in water. They're in water all the time. They can't survive out of water, so they don't even think about being in the water. So how many times have it you and I been in cultural situations or work situations or family situations that you think that that's all there is, that this is the norm, this is the way it should be, when in fact, in reality, maybe it's not the way it should be because you're just so used to being in that circle for so long that that's what you think is norm. A guy named Idris Shah writes, study the assumptions behind your actions. Study the assumptions behind your actions. Then study the assumptions behind your assumptions. Study the assumptions behind your assumptions. I think all of us have gotten into situations in our lives when we fail to study the assumptions of our assumptions. Susan Cooper shares a story that I thought was kind of silly. Our perceptions, she writes, or assumptions can be a great help or a great hindrance. I have a friend who calls perceptions snapshots, a picture, if you will, of something that sticks with us that we hold on to be good, bad, or somewhere in between. Sometimes if we don't take the time to look a little deeper, we can develop a very mistaken point of view. A few years back, my husband and I were out to dinner with another couple, a friend of ours, and my husband's friend was the head of an animal control place and for a large county and always had some very interesting stories to tell. So this night, the couple happened to be a bit late, and when they arrived, they were both laughing and said, boy, do we have a story for you. So our friend had employees and who were friends with a couple who owned a dog, and the couple's dog liked to jump the fence of the neighbor next door and try to play with the neighbor's big white pet rabbit, who was often in the neighborhoods in the neighbor's yard. So the dog never hurt the rabbit at all. He just wanted to play. So the couple's dog would race around and just wag a tail at the rabbit. And even still, this was an obvious problem for both couples. But somehow they were able to coexist. So the two couples and neighbors never got to know each other except for the occasional fence jumping, really, and that separating the two pets. And this went on for, you know, several years. So the couple with the dog had come home late one night and let the dog out to play in the backyard. They were tired and paid little attention to their dog's activities. They heard the dog frantically barking and growling and went to see what was going on. In the dog's mouth was the white rabbit. The rabbit wasn't moving. He was really dirty and the rough for wear and tear, and they were horrified and panicked. Oh my goodness, our dog had killed our neighbor's pet rabbit after all these years. So the couple removed the rabbit from their dog's mouth and put it in a box and stared at it. Their dog just whimpered and was acting very strangely. The couple asked, "What should we do?" They talked for a long time. They're wringing their hands and feeling terrible about the rabbit. And the big question was, what were they going to tell the neighbors about their white rabbit? So in the meantime, they had noticed that their neighbors weren't home, and it appeared that they hadn't been when their dog had jumped the fence. So the couple came up with this idea. They talked about it for a minute, deciding what they should do, and the couple washed the rabbit and blue-dried its fur and combed and fluffed him up to make him look like he was still alive. It was a masterpiece, they thought. Leaving their dog in the house, they snuck over to the absent neighbor's backyard and carefully placed a clean rabbit in the place where he would usually play. Then they snuck back to their house and just waited. And they waited. That seemed to be like a very long time. Then they heard the other neighbors arrive and they listened. Nothing happened, so they went about their evening but kept an ear open to any noise just in case they heard something. Then it happened. The woman's neighbor started screaming. They were obviously very distraught. Duh. The couple stared at each other and decided they needed to go ask what was wrong. Leaving their nervous and agitated dog in the house, they went out to the adjoining fence and peered over and saw the neighbor staring at their fluffed up dead rabbit. The neighbors were frozen in place, not moving towards their pet. They said, "What's wrong?" The woman neighbor stared at them for a bit and said, he came. The couple with the dog looked at each other and then the dead rabbit asked, "What do you mean?" So the neighbor explained, "What we meant was our rabbit passed away yesterday, and we buried him near his favorite spot. And when we came home, there he was," pointing to the fluffy dead rabbit. All the couple with the dog could say was, "Oh." The neighbor's husband then moved towards their deceased fluffy dead rabbit, and he realized that the rabbit was still dead. And he looked upset and very, very confused. That was the couple with the dog noticed a hole in the neighbor's garden. The couple stared at each other and then gave their neighbor their condolences in the most sincerest fashion possible. Then they turned and went back to their home, and they didn't know what to think. We later learned the couple had surmised that their dog had jumped the fence, found the grave of his rabbit friend, and dug him up. The dog was upset that the rabbit wasn't moving and brought him to them for help, which explained the strange behavior. The couple never did tell the neighbors what they had done. How could they? They just keep it their little secret. The rabbit was reburied in a different place, and a new fence was put in the place. And the end of the story is sometimes it pays to dig a little deeper before we make a snap judgment or an assumption. Now, that specific story has never happened to anybody I know, but we have had similar stories that has happened to us, all of us, I think, where we make those snap judgments about things. Then after the fact, we look at it and realize, "Oh, that was so stupid. Why didn't I look a little deeper? Why didn't I do my homework a little more instead of thinking about it?" Turn over to John chapter 4. In the Message paraphrase, it shares the story that I want to share with you today. Society places assumptions in your mind. Again, society places assumptions in your mind. In the book of John, starting in the first verse, in the Message paraphrase by Eugene Peterson, it says, "Jesus realized that the Pharisees were keeping count of all the baptisms that he and John performed, although his disciples, not Jesus, were doing the baptism. They had posted the score that Jesus was ahead, turning him and John into rivals in the eyes of the people. So Jesus left Judean countryside and went back to Galilee. To get there, he had to pass through a place called Samaria. He came to Sychar, a little town that bordered the field Jacob had given his son Joseph, and Jacob's well was still there. And Jesus was worn out by the trip, the paraphrase says, and sat down at a well. It was about noontime. So in verse 7, it says, a woman, a Samaritan, came to draw water. And Jesus said, would you give me a drink of water? His disciples had gone to the town to buy food for lunch. Now, in verse 9, it kind of clarifies why this is such a big story in this context. So the woman was taken aback, asked, how come you, a Jew, are asking me, a Samaritan woman, for a drink? So Jews in those days wouldn't be caught dead talking to a Samaritan. Jesus answered, if you knew the generosity of God and who I am, would you be asking me for a drink? I would give you fresh living water. The woman said, sir, if you don't even have a bucket to draw with, and this well is deep, so how are you going to get this living water? Are you a better man than our ancestor Jacob, who dug this well and drank from it? He and his sons and livestock can pass it down to us. Jesus said, everyone who drinks of this water will never thirst again. It goes on down. It's verse number 16. He said, go and call your husband and then come back. She said, I have no husband. That's nicely put, the paraphrase says. I have no husband. You've had five husbands, and the man you're living with now isn't even your husband. You spoke the truth here, sure enough. So again, the story continues. So if you go down to verse 23. If you who are on the way to live that count before God, your worship, the story says, your worship must engage in your spirit and your pursuit of faith. Skip down to verse 25. The woman said, I don't know about that. I do know that the Messiah is coming. When he arrives, he'll tell a different story. He said, I am he. You don't have to wait any longer or look anymore. And this is where it gets a little interesting. Verse 27. Just then, the disciples, the guys that followed Jesus around and helped in a variety of areas, came back, and they were shocked. They couldn't believe he was talking with, quote, this paraphrase says, that kind of woman. No one said what they were thinking, but their faces showed it. So the end of the story says that the woman went and told everybody about Jesus. So she was an unlikely evangelist. She didn't have the title. She didn't have the hat. She didn't have the degree. Nothing. But she had a story to tell. And I think oftentimes we forget the people that are most unlikely have the best stories to tell. Because, again, we put them in a box. We put ourselves sometimes in a box and assume that people that are unlike us don't have the talent or don't have the story or don't have the credentials that we have, which, again, we come from a point of ego. We come from a point of pride. This really has no place for us. Again, society places assumptions in your mind. Jesus wasn't constrained by the constraints of his religion when it came to making a positive change in people's lives. In that culture, and I've shared this quite a few times, that in that culture, the irreligious went to the religious, whereas in Jesus' mind, Jesus went to the non-religious to change their lives. And that system hasn't changed for a long time. Malcolm Gladwell is a fantastic author, if you've read any of his books. He says it would be interesting to find out what goes on in that moment when someone looks at you and draws all sorts of conclusions. Again, Malcolm Gladwell says, it would be interesting to find out what goes on in that moment when someone looks at you and draws all sorts of conclusions. So as you judge, guess what? You're being judged. And I think that we're being judged way more. In fact, I know you and I are being judged way more than we can even think, because folks look at us from all kinds of different angles and all kinds of situations. They assume certain things about all of us. Brian Davis writes, assumptions are unopened windows that foolish birds fly into, and their broken bodies are evidence gathered too late. We just, again, I'll say it multiple times here today. There's a story I read. Let me make sure I get who told the story right quick. Forgive me a second. I should have wrote that at the top of the story. forgot who wrote it. Anyway, there was an extraordinary time, this party this guy wanted to have. It was in a plush ballroom of a grand hotel, and there were no famous celebrities at all. But this guy named Tony, he wanted to have a party. He was held at 3 a.m. in a small seedy cafe in Hawaii. The guest of honor was a prostitute. And the fellow guests were prostitutes. And the man who threw it was a Christian minister. The idea came to Christian minister, his name, the author of the story, was Tony Campolo. Very early morning one day, he sat in the cafe. He was drinking coffee at the counter. And when a group of prostitutes walk in and took their stools around him, one of the girls' name was Agnes. And she said that it was her birthday, you know, tomorrow, and that she had never had a birthday party. Tony thought it would be a great idea to surprise Agnes with a birthday party. Learning from the cafe owner, a guy named Harry, that the girls came in every morning around 3:30 a.m., and Tony agreed with him to set the place for a party. So word somehow got out on the street, and that by 3:15 the next morning, the place was packed with prostitutes, the cafe owner and Tony and his wife. So when Agnes walked in, he saw the streamers and balloons and Harry holding a birthday cake and everybody screaming out, "Happy birthday!" And Agnes was overwhelmed. The tears poured down her face as the crowd sang happy birthday. When Harry called on her to cut the cake, she paused. When Harry called out to she never had a birthday cake before and wondered if she could take it home and show her mom. When Agnes left, there was stunned silence. Tony did what a Christian minister should. He led Harry's wife, in a room of prostitutes in prayer for Agnes. It was a birthday party rarely seen in Hawaii, thrown by a Christian minister for a 39-year-old prostitute who had never had anyone go out of their way to do something so special for them. Indeed, so surprising was this turn of events that the cafe owner found it really hard to believe. There were churches that would do this sort of thing. But if there were then that sort of church, he'd be prepared to join. Meaning that if he saw other people doing that, then he would join that church because they went out of their way to do something special for a prostitute that's ignored and judged and stereotyped by most people. There's a story in the book of 1 Samuel chapter 16, which illustrates that sometimes statistics can be wrong. Statistics can be wrong when it comes to making wrong assumptions. Years ago, I stopped watching local news. I did. I mean, probably, I can probably count on one hand the last time I watched news in the last 2 or 3 years. Because the first quarter, maybe a third of the news program is all about stereotypes. It's all about the bad news. It's all about what's wrong with stuff instead of what's right with stuff. So it started to give me some sort of a mental, I don't know what you call it, a roadblock or an assumption about certain things. And I knew were wrong assumptions, so I just stopped watching it. In this story, in 1 Samuel chapter 16, it's not only that story. It kind of illustrates it, I think, in a better way. 1 Samuel 16 says in verse number 1, "Now the Lord said to Samuel," let me just back up a bit. In Scripture, the Israelites prayed for a king. They had prophets for years and years and years and years. But they wanted a king like the other kingdoms. They wanted to have a king that to rule over them. So longer story short, they chose this guy Saul, S-A-U-L, who was a very tall man. And you'll understand what I mean momentarily. So in 1 Samuel 16, verse 1, it says, "Now the Lord said to Samuel," now Samuel was chosen to go find a new king. God rejected Saul because Saul did some messed up stuff. So it says, "How long will you grieve over Saul?" This is God talking to Samuel. "Since I have rejected him from being king over Israel." So he says, "Fill your horn with oil and go." That in that context, in that story, in that culture, the prophet would anoint or put oil on the head of whomever that they were praying for or anointing king. "So I'll send you to Jesse, a guy from Bethlehem, for I selected a king for myself among his sons." Verse 2. But Samuel said, how can I go? When Saul hears of it, he'll kill me. So God gives him an idea of what to do to kind of pacify King Saul's jealousy, possibly. So in verse 6, the story says, when he entered to this home, this family, he looked at Eliab, which was one of the older kids, and he said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. In other words, he looked at him and said, you know, surely he looks like a king. He's probably the one. He's probably the one that's going to replace Saul. So God tells him in verse 7, tells Samuel, in that he says, don't look at the appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. Now, let me just pause a moment. That sometimes we assume what is needs to be, or what was needs to continue in that same vein. Saul was tall, so the next king must be tall, is my point here. But in verse 7, it says, but God sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. So verse 8, then Jesse called another son and brought him before Samuel. And not with this one. So Jesse made another one come by. I'm down in verse 10 now. Then Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel. But Samuel's like, dude, this is it. This is all you got. Now, seven sons is a lot, you know, in my world for sure. But he says there remains one more, the youngest, the baby of the bunch, the runt of the litter. And he, in fact, he's not even so important to be here. He's last on the list. He's out taking care of the sheep. So in verse number 11, he said to Jesse, are these all the kids? There remains yet the youngest. He's tending the sheep. Then Samuel said to Jesse, send and bring him, for we will not sit down until he comes here. So if you go down to First Samuel here, chapter 16, verse 7, again, another way to say it is God doesn't judge by the outward appearance. He judges based on the heart or the intention, or maybe where the person's love is for other people. So as most of us know the story, that eventually David came and he was anointed king. And if you fast forward just a little bit more, he was still thought of as less important when the brothers were out preparing to, at least looking like they were going to prepare to fight this enemy. David was on the backside. He was again not part of the group. But yet God saw what was in David. I'll end with one more story. A guy named Kent Crockett shares. He says, driving to the office this morning, I noticed a woman driving 65 miles an hour with her face up to her rear view mirror, putting on eyeliner. I looked away, and the next thing I know, she was halfway in my lane, still putting on her makeup. As a man, I don't scare easily. But she scared me so much, I dropped the electric shaver, which knocked the donut out of my other hand. In my confusion of trying to straighten out the car using my knees against the steering wheel, it knocked my cell phone away from my ear, which fell into the coffee between my legs, ruined the phone, soaked my trousers, and disconnected an important call, all because of that crazy woman driver. So the point is, how many times don't we kind of point the finger so much at certain people doing stuff, and then we fail to look at how stupid we're looking when we're doing some stupid stuff ourselves. That's another story, that's another sermon, that's another article I'll write. But oftentimes we look back, I do, I can't speak for you, but I look back at all the stupid stuff I've done and realize, what was I thinking at the time? That's another sermon. I'll end with Proverbs chapter 28. Proverbs 28, a paraphrase of the text says, don't jump to conclusions. Don't jump to conclusions. There may be a perfectly good explanation for what you just saw. I'm in Proverbs 25:8. Don't jump to conclusions. There may be a perfectly good explanation for what you just saw. So I end with all these stories I just shared, all these examples, all these illustrations, all these quotes, that maybe we are making assumptions at the wrong time about the wrong people without having all the facts. So maybe we should invest the time, invest the energy, invest the passion, invest whatever you need to invest to get all the facts before you jump and to conclude something that's probably very, very wrong about the other person or people in your life because we don't know the whole backstory.
I'm so fired up about my fourth book that came out. It's called Build Your Foundation, 68 Building Blocks for a Successful and Rewarding Life. I've compressed about 25 years of knowledge and experience and learning from a lot of people to help you in your life. You can get a copy of it over at TremendousLifeBooks.com. Again, TremendousLifeBooks.com. Here's some more information about it. For the last 25 years, I've visited with thousands of people in their homes. Many of these people I've met with have no goals, no dreams, no ambitions, and no roadmap for their life. I've seen so many people sitting on their front porches watching life go by. In 2006, my wife and I started building our home with bedrooms for each of our six kids. I always made sure that the foundation of our home was solid. I didn't want to take any chances with the lives of my family. So it is with life. My book, Build Your Foundation, 68 Building Blocks of a Successful, Rewarding Life, is jammed full of ideas that can help you today. My book is a collection of ideas and short stories really designed to help you turn your life around and to help impact the people that you care about and that you love so much. Whether you're just beginning to lay your foundation or you've already built your life but need to shore up some weak spots, Build Your Foundation will help you fortify yourself for a lifetime of success and to give you the courage to go for your dreams in life. Don't miss out on what you can accomplish. You can scale any height and achieve any goal. This book will help you get there. I have a passion to help millions of people change their lives. This book is easy to read, has short chapters, and can help you right now and change your life today. I believe in you.
Thank you so much for listening to the John Carver Show. If you want more information about me, just simply go to my website, www.johnwcarver.com. Again, thanks so much for listening to the show today, and remember, I believe in you.
Thank you for listening to the John Carver Show. Please tune in again right here Monday through Friday for more insights and opinions on how you can reach your goals and dreams in life.